Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his State of the Union address, President Trump alleged that the United States was on a dangerous course toward socialism.
We are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
We're talking about socialism today, how the term is being used on the political stage. We'll hear from a political scientist and historian later on. Washington Post senior political reporter Aaron Blake recently wrote about the prospects for socialism in the U.S. We'll post a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Aaron Blake joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of the president's kind of bringing that up out of it, apparently nowhere, the idea that the country is moving towards socialism?
Well, I think we can say a couple things. One is that this is not a new strategy at all. I actually look back, and in 1950, in the midterm elections, the Republican Party ran on a slogan of liberty versus socialism. So this is something that has come up regularly. We saw it, of course, during the Obama years, most notably when it came to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Republicans have wielded this as kind of a boogeyman in politics for many, many years. I think the second thing is that we can say right now, the Democratic Party is increasingly becoming much more comfortable with having this fight over whether they support much more government activism, much more spending in areas like infrastructure. We're talking about single-payer health care, jobs guarantees, things like that. These are all things that even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, just simply would not have been things the Democratic Party would ever broach on this kind of scale. And so I think that the Republican attacks on Democrats for being big government and you know, allegedly being socialist, it has maybe a new bit of currency given the current breakdown of our politics.
All right. So what is the evidence that Democrats are more comfortable with that? It doesn't necessarily mean, like, for instance, Sherrod Brown, the Ohio senator who's considering a run for president, he's not into the Medicare for All group, but he's not shutting it down either.
Yeah, it's more anecdotal at this point than anything. The Green New Deal came out last week, which was sponsored by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is herself a Democratic socialist. That is not the same thing as a socialist, but it is certainly in that direction. And instantly, you know, this is the program that includes $4.6 trillion for infrastructure spending. It includes a jobs guarantee. It has many, it basically says that we want to create a rail system that is going to make flying obsolete. This is all very expansive vision for government activism. And a number of 2020 presidential candidates instantly jumped on board. A number of them are supporting Medicare for All or single-payer health care. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has talked about a jobs guarantee. So, you know, not all of these proposals are universally supported, but we are seeing a number of prominent Democrats, including the ones who could be our next president, who are attaching their brands to some of these proposals that the Democratic Party simply hasn't been comfortable with for a number of years. And so it's not necessarily something we see in the polling or anything like that, but it is something where there is a comfort level among these Democratic candidates that we simply haven't seen before with big government spending.
And why do you think that is?
I think that there, if I had to guess, it would be a combination of a few things. One is that the Democratic Party broadly feels like they have, you know, kind of unilaterally disarmed when it comes to proposing things that might be seen as extreme. They see what the president has done with very restrictive immigration policies, with a number of other very controversial proposals, and he won the presidency. He is, you know, had a seat at the table as the president of the United States, despite being a rather extreme politician in many ways. And then I also see, I think that they see the rise of people like Ocasio-Cortez. They see the rise of some of these more liberal members creating national profiles for themselves. And they think, we can't just let other people, you know, get behind this and not get behind it ourselves. We need to have a bold vision that includes things that maybe we weren't comfortable with before. And so what we have is a setup in the Democratic Party where a lot of these, you know, prominent national figures, potential future presidents, have been warming to this, even as I think the likes of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, still are somewhat uncomfortable with this trajectory for the party. And so it's going to be interesting to see exactly how the Democratic Party more broadly handles that trend towards the left among some of their more prominent members.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're looking back at the idea of socialism, what it means, since the president alleged that the United States was on a dangerous course towards socialism. My guest right now, Aaron Blake. Aaron Blake, he's a senior political reporter for The Washington Post. He's written about this. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, what do you think about the president's remarks at his State of the Union address regarding socialism? It appeared to come out of kind of nowhere, but it looks like, and does it not, Aaron Blake, that this is a strategy, a longer-term strategy heading in to the presidential election cycle?
There's no question, and it was always going to be, given that we've seen this evolution in the Democratic Party. I think it is important to note that the Green New Deal policy we're talking about is not socialism. We can have debates about whether something like single payer is technically socialism. Socialism is defined as the government basically controlling the means of production, the distribution of goods. And so just saying the government is going to spend a bunch of money on these very bold proposals is not the same thing as saying the government is going to take over everything. So that's important. But, I think that if you ask the average American person what they believe to be socialism, a lot of them would probably look at the expansive proposals for spending that we're seeing by Democrats. And they would say that that at least is trending in a direction towards a less capitalistic society and centralizing the power more in the government's control.
Is the issue of the true definition of socialism, does it even matter? I mean, anymore when you bring it up in a political stage?
Well, it should. I think we should all strive to be clear about what exactly is socialism and what is not. And so when the president, undoubtedly is going to look at this Green New Deal and say that it's socialism, it's important to note that that's not exactly the case. But these are terms where perception matters. And this country has a long history of reluctance towards socialism. I looked at the polling dating back to the 1950s, and socialism is slightly less of a boogeyman these days, but we still have a situation where a very strong majority of the country, between 55% and 60%, disapprove of the idea. It's a very, I think the numbers show about 35, maybe as high as 40% have ever been in support of the idea of socialism. So this is not a broadly popular concept, and that is going to give Republicans enough incentive, if they didn't already have it, to drive home the idea that this is, in fact, at least a step towards socialism.
All right, step towards socialism. So there are socialistic programs that are some of the most popular programs in the country, right? I mean, Social Security.
Certainly. One of the Social Security is one of the third rails of politics. You talk about reforming Social Security, and people do not like that. That was a very potent line of attack for Democrats, and has been for much of this century, when they talk about Republicans maybe cutting benefits or adjusting the retirement age. But I think that the difference is that people don't generally understand something like Social Security, something like Medicare, as being a kind of socialistic program. And I think to the extent Democrats are going to prosecute this case and embrace more big government proposals, they're going to have to make those distinctions clear. And maybe if they, we saw this in 2016 with Bernie Sanders to some degree, if they point to these programs as big government and things that people actually like that are big government, maybe they can change this debate a little bit and have less of a negative connotation for the idea of government spending.
Fox News host Sean Hannity has made the dangers of far left elements in the Democratic Party. He's made a case about it. He's made it a talking point. He says that far left socialists have taken over the Democratic Party. You mentioned, you know, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi, of course, the Speaker of the House. They're kind of the titular heads of the party. Is there a sense that the party's been taken over by this element, or they're just getting a foothold?
Yeah, I don't know about taken over, but it certainly seems to be the portion of the party that is ascendant right now. You know, the fact that we have these presidential candidates jumping on board with some of these proposals that a few years ago they wouldn't have, I think is a recognition from them about what the base wants. But in politics, what the base wants isn't always beneficial to the party more broadly. If you make the decision that jumping on board with single payer or a jobs guarantee is good for winning the Democratic nomination, that's not the same thing as saying it's going to help the Democrats hold the House where they have to hold conservative territory, or to win in the Senate where they have to win a lot of red states if they're ever going to win the majority back. And so we have seen from the likes of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi some real caution when it comes to some of these proposals, some real caution when it comes to the idea of impeachment of the president. They want to, they're very concerned about making sure that majority math adds up. And so to the extent that these other politicians in their party are creating profiles for themselves and going out more on a limb, that's something that they're going to have to confront going forward.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I recall reading about Donald Trump, that his father was a client of the same lawyer who represented the Senator McCarthy of the notorious early 50s McCarthy hearings. So, yeah, there's a lot of ignorance in the United States about the difference between socialism, democratic socialism, and the rest of it. But I think Trump is doing his classic demagoguery. Hmm. And Americans have to educate themselves lest they fall for it.
Aaron Blake?
We're certainly going to get an education on socialism in the next couple of years here. I think that we got at that a little bit during the 2016 race. Obviously, when Bernie Sanders was running, he defines himself, like Ocasio-Cortez, as a democratic socialist, not a socialist, but a democratic socialist. And we saw attitudes on socialism evolve a little bit, at least in the Democratic Party, whereas we began the campaign with a majority of Americans saying they would never vote for a socialist. And by the end, Bernie Sanders was the most popular candidate in that race, even though he didn't make it to the general election. So the call is right. There needs to be education about exactly what this means. We are going to have that debate, especially if Democrats keep pushing forward with ideas like the Green New Deal. And it's probably a good thing for our society to have that debate.
So what is democratic socialism? It's a party, right?
Yeah, it's a version of, I think it makes sense that the label itself, it's kind of halfway between your average Democratic Party politics and a much more activist approach by the government. So Bernie Sanders has never really called himself a socialist. Ocasio-Cortez does not call herself that, but she belongs to a group called the Democratic Socialists of America, who do advocate for a much more active government role in society. They do not, however, advocate for the government taking over all of American industry, which is what socialism would be.
The means of production and so forth.
Exactly, yes.
Let's see, Matthew in Akron, you're on the air. Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I have a comment and sort of a question. I believe it used to be the law that in each grade in public schools that they taught the Constitution for 2 weeks out of the year. I believe it was in the month of September in every grade as part of the public curriculum. Wasn't it?
I don't know, but what does that have?
In reference to the education.
The idea of the ignorance. Well, I mean, socialism's a form of an economic system. It's not part of the Constitution. Aaron Blake, then there's nowhere in the Constitution that dictates what the economic system will be, is there?
I think that's a complicated question,
yeah.
But certainly the idea that the United States is a capitalistic government is not necessarily something that is ingrained in the Constitution. These are decisions that are made by lawmakers and have been for 250 years about exactly what kind of system that they're going to build within the constraints of the Constitution. And so we've had these debates before, and it's not something that's inherently unconstitutional or anything like that.
Right. Matthew, thanks for that call. And Aaron Blake, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post, addressed the issue of socialism in the wake of the president's remarks about socialism and his State of the Union address. We'll have a link to Aaron's article at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation with an historian and a political scientist about, you know, what kind of attraction this kind of a strategy could have going forward in the 2020 presidential election. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In his State of the Union address last week, President Trump said that the United States was on a dangerous course toward socialism and vowed that America would never become socialist. We're talking about socialism, what it is, how the term is being used on the political stage, and how it's been used in the past. Joining us is Ohio State political scientist Thomas Wood. Welcome back.
Hi.
And Michael Kazin teaches history at Georgetown University. He's the author of the 2012 book, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Michael Kazin, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Michael, what distinguishes socialism from other political systems or forms? I mean, this is an economic system, right? It's not a political thing.
Well, there are different kinds of socialisms. Mao was a socialist. Stalin was a socialist. Fidel Castro was a socialist. But as you, I think, were saying before I got on, so was Bernie Sanders, so is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The big difference between what I call authoritarian socialisms, dictatorial socialisms, and democratic socialism, like the socialism that is practiced in Scandinavian countries, for example, where you have a mixed economy, some capitalist elements, some socialist elements.
Is that what we have now, a mixed economy in the United States?
Well, to some degree. I mean, we are much more capitalist than many countries in the world are. As you know, our healthcare system is, there's some public elements like Medicare and Medicaid, but most people are on private health insurance. Housing is, for the most part, private. Transportation, for the most part, private, except for some subway systems some places and a few bus systems that are public in big cities. In other countries, such as Scandinavia, such as Germany, France, they turn a lot of these public goods into really public goods. You don't have to worry about being able to have a house. You don't have to worry about, if you get unemployed, being able to survive. You don't have to worry about your children going to a good school. You have to worry about your children having childcare, which is either free or very cheap. We don't have those public goods as really public in this country, and that's a big difference, I think.
Thomas Wood, how much does the lexicon matter here? The demonization of socialism, you know, as the president demonstrated in his State of the Union address. Why the scare tactics?
I think it reflects Trump understanding something of how mass attitudes work on this question, insofar as for the typical American survey respondent, socialism is a valence term rather than a meaningful description of specific political policies. So for decades, it's been treated by political scientists as the paradox of American ideology, insofar as Americans have consistently more positive attitudes towards right-of-center political symbols. So capitalism has always enjoyed far better valence evaluations from the average American. But when you name specific political specific policies. They're very, very popular. Specific government agencies are popular. The IRS has 3-2 popularity among American survey respondents. When Americans engage with public services, that the experience is generally very positive. You know, we sit on like state supported public radio on a public university campus. You know? Like,
slow down.
Americans don't feel negatively. People in Central Ohio don't feel negatively about supporting the Buckeyes because the word state is in the name of the university. So socialism, if you were to ask the typical like American survey respondents, socialism might be a little bit negative, but the experience of public goods has been overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah, we all, you know, we pitch in money, Michael Kazin, to pay for things like curb cuts, garbage pickup, military, border patrols, all those kind of things, but we don't think of those as socialist.
Right, we think of them as coming from government, and I think it's certainly true. Most things coming from government, people think are good. They don't want to pay taxes for them, of course. No one wants to pay taxes, but you know, I think it's real important to note that we saw that with the government shutdown. When the government goes away, people are, you know, terrified. What's going to happen? Are we going to have security at the airports? Are we going to have planes flying, you know, safely? So, you know, I think, but socialism is not just about government. I think that's perhaps one trap that sometimes socialists get into. It's really about the idea that people take care of one another and they use government to do that. And the idea that there are certain sort of ways that people can live a dignified life, a decent life that you know everyone should be able to take advantage of. No one should have to go hungry. No one should have to go without health care. No one should go without decent housing and so forth. And you know, it's always been the dream of socialists, democratic ones at least, to build a society where that will be true. And I think that's sort of at the base of still the appeal of socialism to those who call themselves socialists.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Michael Kazin. He's an historian, author, and professor of history at Georgetown University. Also with us, Thomas Wood. He's a political scientist at Ohio State. We're talking about socialism this hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Scott in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Scott. Hello, Scott.
Is that me?
Yep.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, okay. I'm in Delaware, not Columbus, but
oh,
that's okay.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. I just wanted to tell you I really enjoy your show, Ann.
Thank you.
I think that there is a confusion between communism and socialism and any type of socialism that we would evolve into in this country. Because if you look back to when Russia was known as the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the second S in USSR was socialist. And the thing of it is, they identify as socialists, but they have never been socialists. They've only ever been communists. Russia has always been communist. And so when we try to compare socialism like you'd have in Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, any of that, to socialism that Russia would try to identify themselves with, it doesn't compare because you've got communism being demonstrated in Russia and socialism demonstrated in other parts of the world, and they just don't compare.
All right. So, Thomas Wood, what's the difference between communism and socialism?
I think the distinction that would be most meaningful to your listeners would be that if they were to travel from Ohio to any of these countries which we regard as the epitome of like modern democratic socialist states, like so they were to live in the Netherlands or Scandinavia, they would very quickly come to find many of the things that they most like about the democratic ethos of the United States, the idea that people can have strenuous political debates and that not bleed into like legal repercussions for somebody, that people can have political debates at work and people not get fired. Places have coexisted a very strenuous, active democratic disagreement between two fairly polarized political parties and fairly expansive social welfare states. So I don't think the available empirical evidence suggests that if the United States increases its public welfare spending to the point where like a Green New Deal or pursuit of a Medicare for All plan or undergraduate college paid for by the federal government in totality. I don't think that need occasion people to have concern that that would coincide with a decline in America's democratic vitality.
Scott, thanks for that call. You know, Michael Kazin, the history of this, I mean, he makes a good point. That's the Cold War influence on our sensibilities about things like socialism, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, when the Cold War began, you know, close after the end of World War II, it lasted till the early 1990s, really. And so a lot of people my age, I'm 70 years old, you know, grew up thinking, yeah, socialism means tyranny, no free elections, no free speech, putting people in jail for disagreeing with the government. And quite right, if socialism is what, if that is what socialism means, then most Americans, quite rightly, wouldn't want it. And most Americans don't know as much, maybe learning more now, about democratic forms of socialism, because you have people like Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and others who are laying out ideas which have always been very essential to what it means to be a democratic socialist. But most Americans are just learning about it now. And I think, you know, since we're, you know, almost 30 years past the Cold War, most people, especially younger people, people much younger than me, my students, professors, students at OSU too, you know, for them, communism, you know, is really an abstraction. Sorry, I'm turning off my cell phone. And so I think one of the reasons why in polls you see millennials and people even the younger generation of millennials, I forget what it's called, Generation X or something, are more favorable to socialism than capitalism, actually, in many polls, is because communism is just way, way back in the rearview mirror for them. It's very it's a historical detail which they don't know much about.
So we got an email from Jason. He says, when I hear Trump ranting about subjects like socialism or the caravan, I feel like I'm in a production of The Music Man. A guy comes to town, creates an enemy, and creates a solution to the problem, a problem that only he can solve. But I'm wondering, Thomas Woods, what kind of agency does that, I mean, because of what Michael Kazin just described as these newer generations that have the fear of socialism way in their rearview mirror, I'm wondering, who's President Trump talking to?
I mean, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question. So the evidentiary basis for the attitudes of the millennials and the post-millennial generation is mixed. It is unequivocal now, as Professor Kazin indicated, that there is an increase of left-leaning ideology among the folks who were born in the 1980s and onwards. But we don't really know yet how much of that was as a function of the Republican presidents who were in office when they came of age. It's still very, very mixed. Like younger people still express, if you don't ask about capitalism, but you ask about some of the attitudinal basis underlying capitalism, the idea that people should be largely responsible for providing for their own family, people that the competition in the workplace and in school is on balance a good thing. There's really been no movement in some of those attitudes basically in the last 40 years. So while individual policies, that is, there is a huge appetite among young people for the government to do more to redress anthropogenic climate change, there's a huge appetite among young people for the government to do more to address material income inequality, I don't think we can go so far as to suggest that there is a whole root and branch revisiting among young people of some adherence to some American ethos, which is probably a little more capitalistic than the typical Western European person. And so if any of your listeners are sitting at home like feeling really anxious that we are on the verge of a huge move towards the left of center politics and Ohio will look like Norway in a decade, I want to suggest that that's a long way off. And all the things that are being promised by leftist center political figures, I imagine a tiny proportion of that will eventually be delivered.
You know, I'm wondering, Michael Kazin, if our better educated populace, because it is better educated than it was back in 1950, post World War II, the Cold War era, has anything to do with this? The younger people aren't scared of this. It's not a good tactic, or it doesn't affect them the same way as it might have 50 years ago.
I'm not sure it's about education, Anne, so much as it's about the perceived failures of capitalism. Now, obviously, Thomas is right. We're not about to jump into being Norway or Sweden. You need a political movement, a large socialist movement, for that to happen. And right now, we have a small but growing one, but certainly not large enough to vault us into a very different kind of system. But I think it's important. You know, a lot of this new surge in socialist sentiment among young people and among some people on the left wing of the Democratic Party of different ages really, I think, begins in a serious way with the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and the idea that, you know, the Great Depression in the 1930s also generated a surge in sentiment for socialism. The Socialist Party grew then. The Communist Party, homegrown American Communist Party, grew then as well. Not arguing for tyranny, but arguing for some form of socialism. So I think in some ways the response we're getting now, the much more positive response to socialism, really comes from the perceived collapse of a certain dream about capitalism lifting all boats. And, of course, also people are more and more aware that inequality has increased in this country, not in the last just 10 years, but in the last 40 years. And there are lots of reasons for that we haven't got time to go into, but I think socialism seems, even in the abstract, you know, worth looking at in a way it did not 20 years ago to a lot of people.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Interesting discussion. I wanted to bring up the case of Spain, which right now has government with a party whose official title is the Socialist Workers' Party of Spain. And what's interesting about this Spanish situation, I think, is twofold. First of all, it's peacefully alternated with a conservative government over about the last 40 years. And so when Trump or other politicians say that socialism is the same thing as loss of liberty, well, Spain's been a democracy ever since the death of Franco. And so the idea that you're going to have a socialist government doesn't necessarily mean that at all. On the other hand, there are cases like Venezuela, where you have a nightmare socialist government right now. But what's interesting is that the Spanish government, the socialist government of Spain, is one of the Western governments that's opposing the dictatorship of Maduro. So the idea that there's any relation between socialism and loss of liberty is just as fatuous as any notion that capitalism immediately means slavery. Capitalism has encouraged slavery. You look at the United States before the Civil War, for example, and at the same time, there are many capitalist countries that have encouraged liberty in one way or another. Okay. So the labels of socialism and capitalism, I don't think we should really consider as equivalent to the idea of liberty.
Yeah, but that is something that they're often conflated. Are they not, Thomas Wood?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'd recommend any of you listeners who are interested in this, Herbert McCloskey, who's now passed away, but he spent many decades at the University of California. When he was concerned in the 1960s that Vietnam was fraying the American political elites at the edges, and the American political class was now devoid of a common American ethos, he spent decades researching this coexisting commitment to democracy and capitalism as generally regarded as positive political symbols across the American public. This is research that I'm revisiting now in the 21st century, and it really is impressive. Despite all the Sturm und Drang, despite the extent to which we have incredibly historically polarized political parties, and we have this sense that the American political class is grinding to a halt and we can't address big problems anymore, it doesn't appear to be the case that we're fraying the political consensus, the American public. Broadly democratic, broadly capitalistic political symbols remain very, very popular among younger voters, among older voters, among elites, among the public, across the political spectrum.
Can I make a comment, Anne?
Sure.
About what the previous caller said?
Yeah.
you know, I think it's important to say that, you know, economic systems don't necessarily go along with specific political structures.
Mm-hmm.
Nazi Germany was a capitalist country. Fascist Italy was a capitalist country. There was a state role there, but basically private business did quite well as long as they supported the government.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, China under Mao and even now and the Soviet Union had socialist economies, but they were not democratic. So you can have a lack of democracy in a capitalist system and a lack of democracy in a socialist system as well. You know, so often, and this is true in President Trump's State of the Union address too, this assumption that you bring in socialist elements in the economy and liberty goes out the window. But the same could be said for capitalist elements, as in Chile, for example, in the early 1970s, where the U.S. helped overthrow a socialist government, which was popularly elected, and then what happened? You got basically military dictatorship, and they brought in free market economy. So the two don't necessarily go together at all.
We're going to continue our conversation. What's socialism? What does it have to do with what President Trump warned of in his State of the Union address? If you have a question or comment, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about socialism. What is it and how the term is being used on the political stage after President Trump warned of a kind of creeping socialism during his State of the Union address? Still with us, Ohio State political scientist Thomas Wood, and by phone from Georgetown University, historian and author of the 2012 book, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, Michael Kazin. 614-292 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. In a recent interview, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said that, quote, we're not going back to socialism. We're going on an economic plan for America that works. He said, quote, we don't believe in a centralized planned economy where the government puts restraints on it. So, you know, he said what I'm interested in, Michael Kazin, is the idea that we're not going back to socialism. Is there any sensibility there? What's he talking about?
Yeah, I mean, he's probably, if you asked him, he would probably say, we're not going back to the Soviet Union. I don't think, I mean, who knows, the president, with all due respect, doesn't know very much about American history at all, and perhaps the Treasury Secretary doesn't know much either. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've never had a socialist country, and have we had larger government programs in the past? Not really. During the New Deal, there was, you know, job creation of the WPA and the CCC and other agencies like that, but they certainly weren't socialists. So no, there's not much sense in that. you know, but again, as Professor West was saying, I mean, there's a way in which socialism is a scare word for a lot of Americans, especially older ones, and the fact that the Treasury Secretary is saying this, and he's a top government official, and he's echoing what the president says, mm-hmm. Is a way of putting people who are favorable to socialism on the defensive, and that is the point of it.
Let's see. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I was just going to say I'm a millennial, and I'm in favor of socialism. I love Bernie. I voted for Jill Stein. And, I mean, I just see the failures of capitalism. Millions of Americans are one paycheck away from being homeless. There are more empty houses than there are homeless people. Just something doesn't add up.
So it's that inequality, the income inequality, that's troubling you.
Correct.
And you're a millennial, and Thomas Wood, he fits a definite profile.
Yeah, there is pretty clear evidence now that impressions of the success of the U.S. macroeconomy to address the human needs of Americans does relate very strongly to attitudes about capitalism and socialism. I think it is of relevance. It turns out that the average person has pretty biased towards the negative impressions of just how well the American macroeconomy has done. People tend to perceive that inequality is higher, is getting worse than it is. And so I don't want to change anyone's mind today, but the American macroeconomy is doing okay at some things, I guess. And so insofar as the listener has meaningful concerns, the millennials have been dealt a fairly sort of, unfair generational hand on some questions, especially about the ability for them to access things like real estate markets. That I think is pretty it's to be expected that they would at least think about alternative economic arrangements.
Let's see. Thanks for that call, Chris. We appreciate it. On the same score, JJ in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, JJ.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate the show.
You bet.
I'm a leftist and anti-capitalist, and I'm probably further to the left than, Bernie and Ocasio-Cortez. But I wanted to point out that, part of the point of socialism is liberation. And liberation, not just economically, but of marginalized peoples. And, especially here in America, liberation of Black, brown, gay, trans, just all marginalized communities, and ending the oppression and the systematic racism that's been going on for 400 years.
Hmm. Michael Kazin, does that ring resonate with you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that's happened to the left generally, and socialists especially since the 1960s, is they've gotten focused not just on class inequalities, but obviously also on racial inequalities, gender inequalities, inequalities of based on sexual preference. This is not an easy thing to put together. There's a lot of talk about intersectionality, people on the left, all these different kinds of exploitations and oppressions work together in various ways. That's true, but socialists historically in this country and elsewhere have always wanted to put the focus on economic inequality, social inequality, inequality based on the relationship between employers and workers and wanting to make as I said before, public goods, more available, more cheaply and universally to everybody. It's certainly true that socialists are in favor of all the things that the caller talks about. But one could argue that certain civil rights, of course, for African Americans, for women, for homosexuals, can be won, at least legal rights can be won within a capitalist system and have been to a certain extent, at least.
The point was made, though, on a recent program that I wanted to raise to you in that context is that, for the emancipation of the slaves, the slave population, at the end of the Civil War, when that occurred, the people who fought, the generals and that kind of thing, who fought for the Union in the Civil War, they were rewarded with millions and millions of acres of property across the country. But bottom line is the emancipated people who were enslaved were not given that kind of economic foothold. And that kind of set us on a path that we're still sort of treading today.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course, that's true. No, as I said before, legal rights. I mean,
those help, but money helps.
In fact, for that matter, the end of Reconstruction meant slowly but surely even the right to vote was taken away from black men who had had it in the South during Reconstruction.
JJ, thanks for that call. Let's see if I can squeeze in another one. Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Unlike the previous caller, I am not an extreme leftist. However, I am definitely a supporter of Bernie Sanders. And I'd like to focus on a couple of things. I am actually a Canadian,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't mentioned that country in your discussion, but Canada has, since 1949, had a single-payer health system.
Mm-hmm.
It was started by the New Democratic Party, which was a socialist party in the sense of modern democratic socialism. Canada has, by and large, been far more left-leaning than the United States, and far less influenced by oligarchs, by the big money interests like the Koch brothers and other scavengers. And as a consequence, we have a democracy up there. It is a different system. It's parliamentary versus the American system, and yet it works. I think the only thing that my right-leaning friends say is, you know, you have death panels and your system is too expensive and there's too much that you have to pay for and you don't get enough coverage and you can lose your life, all of which are wrong. And it typifies the basic ignorance that Americans generally have about the concept of socialism, which is really nothing more when you think about it than community. And we've, you know, this country has been founded on so many different communities, folks who share common interests pulling together with a common goal. And that's really the bottom line on socialism. It isn't government control. There is some aspect of that. But the bottom line is it's about people helping people, as one of your speakers.
Well, I made the point earlier that a lot of people think about it in terms of these giant programs like Medicare and Medicaid, that kind of a thing. But it's what we all of our tax dollars, Thomas Wood, we pitch in our money and then we get the economies of scale we enjoy the economies of scale that offers, and we can get curb cuts and sidewalks and garbage pickup.
I mean, I agree. And I think if you asked an external, objective viewer to sort of assess how well the American political system is doing with the topic the caller raised about America changing the way it provides health insurance and health care, they'd suggest that the American political system seems to be moving forward in fits and starts towards a fairly sort of rational consideration of the perspectives. You know, a decade ago, we pursued a sort of a half-hearted increase of government intervention into insurance marketplaces. Now, most of the candidates running on the Democratic side for president have undertaken to be part of their policy agenda to advocate for some sort of either single-payer or multi-payer national healthcare system. And so, in a sense, it seems like a fairly sort of typical thing in the American political experience that we are keeping most of the trappings of a capitalist system and deciding that in this one particular marketplace, the American public will debate whether they want more intervention.
Michael Kazin, why has the U.S. come to this trajectory so differently than so many other countries? Is it because we're just so big?
Ah, got 2 minutes, huh?
Yeah, you've got two minutes to give me 20 years of.
Well, I think a big reason, and look, Canada right across the border there. A big reason is slavery, actually, and the whole history of not just slavery, but Jim Crow and people identifying themselves, you know, with most people with a majority race and thinking that being white is better than something else, and you should keep, you know, people who are not white down in one way or another. Mm. That's really important. You know, identity, how people identify themselves has a lot to do with what they think about politics, and what they think about politics a lot to do with what kind of system they want to support. And, you know, Canada has a lot of similarities to the United States, but one thing it didn't have, it never had slavery. In fact, it was a place where slaves escaped, as you know, when they could. So that's an important difference, I think, when you have a very strong class feeling, a feeling of solidarity, of community, as across ethnic groups, as the caller put it. It's much more possible to think about programs like national health insurance that everyone benefits from, everyone pays into, with higher taxes in many cases. When you have a sense of white people, you know, have it better and should have it better, then you don't have the same kind of situation, unfortunately.
Michael Kazin, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Glad to do it.
Michael Kazin, historian, author, and professor of history at Georgetown University. Thomas Wood, thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
My Pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Wood, professor of political science at Ohio State University. Thanks for your great calls. Thanks for your emails. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.